This podcast contains explicit content. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Creepy Cannabis Podcast, where we chat all things creepy, cannabis, true crime, paranormal, and weird. I'm Madeline.
I'm Rachel. She looked at me because I usually say so much extra. But I didn't. So here we are. What is this strain? This strain has me geeking so hard in my mind and out loud. What is it?
Where's the letter?
It was in my hands.
Oh my god.
Oh my god. Do you guys see the abuse I endure every single time I come here? And by abuse, I mean free product, a comfy bed, a comfy duvet, snacks. Very inconvenient.
Great.
What are we smoking?
The strain today is called Big Tie, which is... doesn't have a lot of information on it. It's a sativa-leaning strain, but I was going to talk about the three different strains that it's supposedly lineage. It's lineage.
It's Big Thai like Thailand, not like Thai something.
Mm-hmm. Thailand. So Big Bud is a cross between Afghani and Skunk Number One.
Oh, is that what that flavor is?
Well, it's a mix of many different flavors because that's only one of the parents.
Oh, shit. Oh.
And this one is more of like an indica leaning, so it's like a... it's more sedative and gives you feelings of euphoria, slowly eases you into a deep and peaceful sleep. So it's ideal for anyone who suffers from insomnia and chronic pain. That's Big Bud.
I've definitely been having some really bad insomnia since getting the puppy. And, like, low-key, I was gonna have to not stay because I have my goddaughter tomorrow. And Sean knew that if I, again, didn't sleep, I was going to spontaneously combust. And he was like, I'll watch her in the morning. You go. And then I walk in and Maddie got a brand new duvet cover. Mm-hmm. Is the actual duvet new, too? Or just the cover?
Oh, everything.
It's, like, the most plush experience. Mm-hmm. Like, I got right in that bed immediately under those covers.
I usually sleep in it alone.
Well, I've got you. I'll spoon you.
So, Afghan, one of the other parents, is good for stress, pain, insomnia, anxiety, migraines. Really good for sleep, helping you feel creative and happy, euphoric. Also indica leaning, it is really good if you can't sleep at night, so very good for sedation.
I feel like I'll really like it for my vibe, which is usually, like, I'll kind of sit on the floor and, like, on my coffee table and draw or craft and stuff, and I really, that at that time, I really do like indicas when I can kind of, you get that really big creative buzz, and then you pass out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I don't know, it just always looks such a good sleep.
But then Purple Thai is a very strong sativa strain, so that's the third. It's gives you a lot of euphoria and happiness. It is supposedly good if you want to open your mind.
Oh, I love to open my mind. Mm-hmm. You know me. I'd be doing the tarot on the TikTok.
Good for meditation or yoga.
I did painting. Some like intense breathing yoga the other day. I cannot for the life of me remember the name of it. And the one person suggested doing it after you smoke. And let me tell you something. My ass had an out-of-body experience, and I took the best nap of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Kundalini yoga, that was what it was called. Yeah.
Well, Thai strains are good for use in the morning and can help with stress, depression, and loss of appetite.
I actually have had a very difficult time with my appetite since Zoloft, but I do think it's a little bit tied to some of the stuff I smoke.
Mm-hmm.
But it's to a point now sometimes where I can't eat. Unless I smoke, like, at least a hit or so, because I just, my nausea is so bad.
Yeah, I feel that.
Yeah. But apparently that's pretty common, because I have a lot of people in my circle that smoke. Mm-hmm. We all have similar problems, but it's like as soon as I take like one puff, like I don't have to get high, I can literally take one puff and I'm good to go.
Helps with nausea.
Yeah.
But it also probably habituates your body.
But I have been actually losing a tiny bit of weight, and as you guys all know, I struggle really badly, so it's actually curbing my appetite. Mm. So I've had a really good response with that, and even when I do eat, it'll be like every once in a while I'll get the munchies and I'll eat a good amount, but even when Sean's getting me fast food sometimes, like, I can't finish the meal anymore. Mm-hmm. I'll have the sandwich and I'm good. So I found that it's actually working really well for my healthy weight loss, and it's been slow because it's been a lifestyle change where I just don't eat as much.
Mm-hmm. So there's this thing called, one of the cannabinoids, THCV, that is supposed to be good for weight loss and curbing appetite. It is an appetite-curbing, energy-boosting cannabinoid, THCV.
It definitely, like, that's, like, the biggest...
And a lot of products are starting to have it now because it's a recent discovery.
It's, like, the... It's probably my main benefit I found is, like, it levels my anxiety and it's really helping with my anxious eating, my depressed eating. Like, instead, a lot of times I get into a creative energy instead of, like, a bored, hungry energy. So I personally, like, obviously, you know, we're both advocates. Do you remember when I started the podcast, like, a wee babe?
2 years ago, and this month.
I was, like, it's okay, guys. Not everyone has to smoke. And I still believe that. But now I'd be like, walking it back. However, that's all I have to say on that matter. I need to calm down. I had too many hits. Now I'm hyped.
Well, today we're talking about...
Sometimes you're so perfectly fucking bland. I love it. This guy, anyway. It's like that scene in Loki when he's like... well, never mind, I don't care. Okay, sorry. Today we're discussing, yes.
It's the story of Maura Murray. It's a missing persons case. She was born in 1982 in Massachusetts, the fourth child of the family, and she was raised in a very Irish Catholic household. When she was six, her parents got divorced, and she basically lived with her mom from then out. She graduated from the regional high school, where she was a star athlete on the track team.
Ooh.
Can't relate.
Fucking same. I love that I'm running to the fucking McDonald's.
Unless I'm running for my life. Then probably.
Yeah, because at that time, out there.
Yeah, I literally ran for my life.
And you made it. You were like, oh, you like, were like, listen, bitch.
Pulling those dogs behind me.
You do seem like that zippity type that if somebody tried to abduct you, like, you'd be back and forth, like hopping over shit. I'm the type that would just lay down and go dead weight, and if you, like, can get me, you've earned it. You earned me. Take me. Kill me. Whatever. I don't care. Do I have to go to work tomorrow? Great. Whoa, I should not have had so much fun. Fun puff.
Fun puff.
Not the fun puff. What is the fun? We watched Mean Girls earlier and I'm like, fucking I love sprightly. That movie. I'm sprightly. I'm going to convince her to watch Freaky Friday next.
Oh, I love that movie too.
Oh, okay. No convincing needed. No. Got it.
She was accepted into the into the United States Military Academy in West Point, New York, where she studied chemical engineering for 3 semesters. And after her freshman year, she transferred to the University of Massachusetts Amherst to study nursing. In 2003, 3 months before her disappearance, she admitted to using a stolen credit card to order food from several restaurants, including one in Hadley, Massachusetts. The charges continued in December. The charge of her stealing was in December, and it was dismissed after 3 months of good behavior.
Mm. Did it say, like, what led her to that? Or she just was like, no, this is what happened?
Nope, she just admitted it.
Okay.
On February 5th, 2004, when she was on duty at her campus security job, she spoke on the phone with her older sister. They discussed her sister's relationship problems with her fiancé. Typical.
Yes.
Around 10:30 p.m. while still on her shift, she reportedly broke down in tears. When her supervisor arrived at her desk, she was zoned out. There was really no reaction. She was pretty unresponsive.
Oh, my God.
So, the supervisor escorted her back to her dorm room around 1:20 a.m. Because it was 10:30 p.m. when she was still working. And when she, when asked what was wrong, she said, my sister, and basically there was a conversation, but nobody really knew what it said until 2017 when her sister basically said that she was a recovering alcoholic and had been discharged from a rehabilitation clinic that evening, and on her way home, her fiancé took her to a liquor store, which caused an emotional breakdown.
So she was, like, crying because she was so worried about her sister, who's stupid, dumbass fucking fiancé.
Yeah.
I hate people.
I hate him, too.
Yeah.
On Saturday, February 7th, Maura Murray... Why did I just say her last name like that? Murray's father, Fred, arrived in Amherst. He told investigators later that they went car shopping that afternoon and went to dinner with a friend of Maura. And... she dropped her father off at his motel room, borrowing his Toyota Corolla. She went back to campus to party at a dorm party, as one does. She got there at 10:30 p.m., and then at 2:30 a.m., she left the party. At 3:30 a.m., she was en route to her father's motel. She struck a guardrail on Route 9 in Hadley, causing like $10,000 worth of damage to the car.
Oh, sorry. I was just listening very intently because this is very interesting.
Yes.
I zoned out because I was like, oh my God, what next? Yes.
The responding officer wrote a report, but there was no documentation of any field sobriety tests being conducted. And she was driven to her father's motel and stayed in his room the rest of the morning. At 4:49 a.m., there was a call placed to her boyfriend's... from her dad's phone, and the participants and contents of the phone call are all unknown.
Okay, so you have no idea who used the phone or...
ain't nobody talking, but they know that that...
well, if they spoke to the boyfriend, she should... well, it might not have been her dad. It could have been her.
Yeah.
But why isn't he talking?
I don't know. So, the damage was covered by the insurance, which is great, and he rented a car and dropped her off at school... and then left. At 11:30 that night, he called his daughter to remind her to get accident reports from the Registry of Motor Vehicles for the insurance. And then they agreed to talk again Monday night to discuss all the forms and fill out the insurance claim on the phone. After midnight, on Monday, February 9th, she used her personal computer to search MapQuest for directions to the Berkshires and Burlington, Vermont. The first reported contact that she had with anyone on the 9th was at 1 p.m., and she emailed her boyfriend, I love you more, stud. I got your messages, but honestly, I don't feel like talking too much to anyone. I promise to call you today, though. Love you, Maura. She also made a phone call inquiring about renting a condominium, and it was a condo association where her family had vacationed in the past, I guess, so she was calling to inquire about rentals, and records indicate that the call lasted 3 minutes. The owner did not rent the condo, and then at 1:13 p.m. she called a fellow nursing student, reasons unknown.
This is just so bizarre.
On the afternoon of Monday, February 9th, at 1:24 p.m., she emailed a work supervisor at the nursing school that she would be out of town for a week due to a death in her family. According to her family, there was no death.
No. Okay.
She also said she would contact them when she returned. At 2:05 p.m., she called a number which provides recorded information about booking hotels in Vermont. The call lasted 5 minutes. And then at 2:18, she called her boyfriend and left a voice message saying she would talk to him later.
So, where is she going in Vermont and why?
I don't know. The Berkshires. In her car, she packed clothing, toiletries, college textbooks, birth control. Well, I don't know why they needed to include that. Her room was searched and the campus police discovered a lot of her belongings packed in boxes and art removed from the walls. So it's not clear whether she packed them that day, but police at the time said she packed between Sunday night and Monday morning. On top of the boxes was an email to her boyfriend that indicated trouble in their relationship, I guess.
And this boyfriend, who clearly isn't saying what the conversation with the dad's cell phone was about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
At 3:30, she drove off campus in her 1996 Saturn sedan.
Wait, show that one, I think.
Because classes had been canceled that day due to a snowstorm.
Oh, I can't wait for it to snow.
At 3:40 p.m., she withdrew $280 from an ATM. It showed she was alone at a nearby liquor store. She bought $40 worth of alcoholic beverages, including Bailey's, Kahlua, vodka, and Franzia.
I mean, it sounds like she's going on a romantic getaway to me. Or, like, a girl's weekend.
Mm-hmm. Also, she was alone when she bought the alcohol. At some point in the day, she picked up an accident report from the Registry of Motor Vehicles.
Oh, so she was being responsible. She was acting responsibly. She was planning on studying, presumably, or doing schoolwork. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So she left school between 4 and 5 p.m. via 91 North. She called to check her voicemail at 4:37 p.m., last recorded use of her cell phone. To date, there's no indication she had informed anyone of her destination that evening, nor has there been any evidence that she had chosen a destination, that she just wasn't, like, just driving.
Poofed.
Yeah.
Into the thin air.
So, at 7:27 p.m., like, a little after 7, in Woodsville, New Hampshire, a resident heard a loud thump outside her house. She looked out the window, and she could see a car up against the snowbank on Route 112, also known as Wild Amanusuk. Amanusuk? I don't know.
Where?
Road. Ooh. The car pointed, it doesn't matter. The car pointed west on the eastbound side of the road. At 7:27 p.m., the local woman reported the car accident, and she called the sheriff's department at 7:27 p.m. According to the 911 call, she claimed to have seen a man smoking a cigarette inside the car. However, she later stated that she had not seen a man nor a person smoking a cigarette.
Oh, okay.
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 Got it. But rather, what appeared to be a red light glowing from inside the car, potentially from a cell phone. Now, eyewitness accounts are, like, the most untrustworthy thing in the entire world.
They're so ridiculous. Outrageous. Like, because I feel like your brain sees one thing and then, like, fills in a story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A passing motorist, a bus driver, stopped at the scene. They saw the car as well as a young woman walking around the vehicle. The driver noticed the young woman was not bleeding or injured, but cold and shivering. He offered to telephone for help. She asked him not to call the police and assured him she'd already called AAA. There was no call to AAA, at least from her phone.
The next time I run into somebody that's like, do not call the police, bitch, I'm calling the fucking police. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm a snitch, and I get stitches.
Well, so there was no cellular reception in the area, so he went home and then called the police.
Oh, he did still do it? Yeah. Okay, good for him, man.
They got the call at 7:43 p.m. He was unable to see her car when he made the call because he was at home, but he did notice several cars pass on the road before the police arrived. Another local resident was driving home from work and claimed she passed the scene at 7:37 p.m. and saw a police SUV parked up against the car. She pulled over briefly and did not see anyone inside or outside of the car and decided to continue home.
What is happening?
She needs to mind her business.
She said absolutely goodbye.
That statement contradicts the police log, which says that they arrived 9 minutes after that. But.
So now do we have another eyewitness who's not reliable, or do we have a sketchy police officer? Like, what do we have?
What do we know?
Or somebody pretending to be.
So, according to the police log, at 7:46 p.m., they arrived at the scene, but the driver had disappeared. There was no one inside the car or around it. It had impacted with a tree on the driver's side of the vehicle, severely damaging the left headlight and pushing the car's radiator into the fan, rendering it inoperable. Mm. The windshield was cracked on the driver's side and both airbags had deployed and the car was locked.
If both airbags deployed, somebody definitely was in the car with her, because they don't deploy if there's no...
Mm-hmm. Usually.
That's why you have to register a certain weight on the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Inside and outside of the car, he discovered red stains that looked like red wine. Inside, they found an empty beer bottle, a damaged box of Franzia, and a AAA card issued to Maura. A blank accident report forms that she picked up, some other stuff, jewelry, driving directions to Burlington, Vermont. And the only thing that was missing was her debit card, her credit cards, and her cell phone, none of which have ever been located since her disappearance. They later reported some of the bottles of liquor were also missing.
I'm starting to form a theory in my head, but I'm going to save it till the end.
A summary of the incident is that there was a very hairpin turn, and she basically went off the road, hit a tree with her car on her side, and by the time the police showed up 10 minutes later, she was gone. They obviously traced the vehicle to her and initially treated it as a missing persons case on the belief that she may have wanted to disappear, or just treat her as a missing person, but believe that she may have wanted to disappear voluntarily.
I see.
That was just purely speculation based on her travel preparations, and there was no evidence of foul play, at least that they could find. But in 2009, the case was given to the Cold Case Division, and it's basically just still an ongoing missing persons case.
I always cut you off, so I was like, and then I waited.
Well, there was an alleged sighting, so between 8 and 9:30 p.m., a contractor was returning home and saw a young person moving quickly on foot eastbound on Route 112, east of where her vehicle was discovered. He noted that the young person was wearing jeans, a dark coat, and a light-colored hood. He did not report it to police immediately because he didn't recognize the date, and 3 months later, he... was looking at his work records, and that's when he remembered that he hadn't seen that woman.
Oh.
The night that she had disappeared. The responding officers and the bus driver drove around the area just before 8 p.m. A fire truck arrived to the scene. By 8:49, the car had been towed, and at 9:30, a rag believed to have been part of her emergency roadside kit was discovered stuffed into the muffler pipe. And... yeah, she's just missing. The initial investigation, which was like 2004-2005, there was a report put out the next day, you know, like, obviously a missing persons report, saying that she was reported wearing dark coat, jeans, and a black backpack. A voicemail that was left on her dad's home answering machine at 3:20 p.m. stated that her car had been found abandoned. He was working out of state and didn't receive the call. At 5 p.m., her older sister contacted her father to tell him, and then he contacted the police department and was told that if she wasn't reported safe by the following morning, then that's when they would start a search.
It's outrageous. How many people is this going to happen to?
Yeah, let's just wait until...
No, you don't know your own so-and-so. This is why they left. I can't.
On February 11th, her father arrived at 8 a.m. And to begin the search, a police dog was tracked the scent from one of her gloves 100 yards east from where the vehicle had been discovered, but lost the scent eventually.
And that matches what that guy said, that he saw a person east of the car.
Yeah. This suggested that she left in a vehicle. Usually when they lose the scent immediately, it's because they get in a car. And her boyfriend and his parents arrived in Haverhill at 5 p.m., and he was interrogated by the police and then was joined by his parents for questioning. At 7 p.m., the police said that they believed Maura came to the area either to run away or attempt suicide. Her family believed that that was unlikely.
I don't think you're going to pack toiletries to attempt suicide, to be honest.
I don't either. her boyfriend had turned off his cell phone during his flight. So at some point he got the voicemail, which he believed was the sound of her crying. The call was traced to a calling card issued to the American Red Cross, which is super weird. On February 12th, her father and her boyfriend held a press conference in New Hampshire, and the next day the first press coverage was published, 2 days after she was gone missing. The police reported that she was listed as endangered and possibly suicidal, even though there was no evidence to support that. And they also stated that she was intoxicated at the crash site, although the bus driver said that she did not appear impaired, and they had, again, no evidence of that. And the police chief kept saying, like, our concern is that she's upset or suicidal. Bro, you do not have any evidence of that.
No. Like, this girl is in school. She brought her school books that she intended to study. Yeah. She was making plans, like, actively in the moment.
Mm-hmm. So a week after her disappearance, the family expanded the search into Vermont. And just, the authorities just basically, like, weren't really doing a crazy amount.
No,
and sure. Although missing person cases are normally handled by local and state police, the FBI actually joined the investigation 10 days after she disappeared. They obviously interviewed everyone, friends, family. 10 days after the disappearance, they conducted another ground search and an air search using a helicopter with thermal imaging, tracking dogs, cadaver dogs, all that. Her older sister discovered a ripped white pair of women's underwear lying in the snow on a secluded trail near French Pond Road on February 26, but the DNA test said that it didn't belong to Maura. Who did it belong to?
My theory is making more and more sense.
At the end of February, the police returned the items found in the car to her family, and they basically checked out of their motel. Her dad kept returning, like, every weekend to continue searching. In April, the police informed him of complaints of trespassing on private property and tried to get him to stop.
Like, this person's looking for his missing child. Let him fucking traipse through your yard. He's not digging up the backyard.
I know.
Who fucking cares?
There was a disappearance of a girl named Brianna Maitland in Montgomery, Vermont. And it was, like, 66 miles away from Maura's last sighting, and there were a lot of comparisons due to the similarities in their disappearances, but police say that there's no link between the two cases.
That just means that they don't have anything to confirm or deny.
Correct.
Which is supporting my other possible theory.
In April and again in June, the police dismissed any connection between Murray's case and Maitland's case. And they said that they believe that Maura was headed for an unknown destination and may have accepted a ride in order to continue to that location. They also added that they had discovered no evidence that a crime had been committed and dismissed the possibility of a serial killer being involved. Okay, well, you brought it up. So that means you were thinking of it.
That means they're like, this is not
that means you were considering it as a possibility. Because you said it.
But you said it. I mean, you were thinking it. If you know, you know.
On July 1st, the police retrieved the items. Oh, wait. Didn't I just... No. No. On July 1st, they actually got the items back from her vehicle to do forensic analysis. And on the 13th, a one-mile radius search was performed by, like, 100 people, including state troopers, rescue personnel, volunteers. It was a fourth search around this crash area and the first search that was performed without snow on the ground. And they were most interested in, obviously, locating the black backpack that she had in her possession and wasn't found in the vehicle. But they have not found anything conclusive. In 2004, a man allegedly gave her father a rusty, stained knife that belonged to the man's brother, who had a criminal past and lived less than a mile from where the car was discovered. His brother and his brother's girlfriend were said to have acted strangely after the disappearance, and the man's brother claimed he believed the knife had been used to kill Maura.
At least he was like, hey, fuck it, here, have it.
Several days after the knife was given to his father, her father, the man's brother, apparently scrapped his Volvo, like his vehicle. Mm. Family members of this man who turned in the knife claimed that he had made up the story in order to obtain reward money in the investigation and that he had a history of drug use. Mm. So, who's to know?
And they never, like, were able to link it to her DNA or anything like that, I presume.
I guess. Rude. No. In 2005, her dad petitioned the governor for help in the search. The first anniversary of her disappearance, service was held where the car was found, and her father met briefly with the governor. In 2005, her dad actually filed a lawsuit against several law enforcement agencies with the aim of seeing files on the case. On November 1st, 2005, a user named Tom Davies logged into a message board called, quote, Not Without Peril, which was dedicated to a discussion of her disappearance and claimed to have seen a black backpack behind a restroom on an overlook 30 miles east of Route 112. Obviously, she went missing with the book bag, in theory, and they did not disclose whether this backpack had been taken for forensic testing. In 2006, 10 retired police officers and detectives started working on the case again. And they said, quote, it appears that this is something beyond a mere missing persons case. Something ominous could have happened here. And they offered a $75,000 reward in 2007 for information that could help solve her disappearance.
Maybe offer it when the person goes missing and not 77 years later when people don't even fucking know what you're talking about.
Literally.
It's fine.
In 2006, volunteers led a two-day search within a few miles of where the car was found. In the closet of an A-frame house close to the crash site, cadaver dogs allegedly went crazy, possibly identifying the presence of human remains. The house had formerly been the residence of the man implicated by his brother, who had given her dad the knife. And a sample of carpet from the house was sent to the police, but the results were never released to the public. In 2008, volunteers led another two-day search through the wooded areas of Haverhill, and they had dog teams, private investigators, the whole nine again. Her case was subsequently added to the newly established cold case unit later that year in 2010. Her dad publicly criticized the police investigation for treating the disappearance as a missing persons case and not a criminal matter, and called on the FBI to join in the investigation. And, even in 2009, it was still active, but they really just don't have any information.
Well, I guess not when you don't take a single thing serious.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
I guess I don't understand, like, what's the harm in just being more thorough? And then if it's nothing, okay, then you're more thorough. And then, great. Don't want to be logical or anything.
Hate to be the one to say it, but... more recent developments. In 2014, which is still, like, basically 10 years ago now.
Ew.
Isn't that crazy? On the 10th anniversary of her disappearance, there haven't been any credible sightings of Maura since the night that she disappeared, and there was an article published on the 10th anniversary that reported that her dad essentially believed that she was dead, you know, at this point. Probably abducted the night of her disappearance. In 2017, on the 13th anniversary, they confirmed that it's still an open case with periods of activity, but that it's pretty dormant and that there's no updates to share at this time. In 2019, the 15th anniversary of her disappearance, her dad reiterated that he believed she was dead and his suspicions about the nearby house that the cadaver dogs had responded to. In early April, excavation was done within the basement of the house, and her dad previously wanted to search the home, but the owners did not cooperate, And following sale of the property, the new owners allowed several searches of the property, and the excavation conducted in April found absolutely nothing other than what appears to be a piece of pottery or old pipe.
Hey, at least the new owners were like, yeah, we have souls. You can come here and look for your dead child.
Yeah. In early 2021, the tree where she was last seen was marked with a blue ribbon as a memorial, but was cut down by the property owner.
Why is everyone in this county a fucking dickhole? Like, truly. Crotchetiest Jesus bunch of fucking Christ. Ball sacks I ever heard
Literally,
of.
Literally, yeah.
Damn. Oh, were you trying to mourn the fucking loss of your child? I'm gonna saw that down.
I'm gonna okay. chop that down, bitch.
It's fine. Everything's fine. Okay.
Shortly after a request from her family to have a historical marker placed at the site was submitted in late 2020, but it was turned down by the New Hampshire Division of Historical Resources.
I'm trying to decide if I want to hop on the soapbox really quick. I do. Ultimately, yes, correct, I do. When you lose a person, it does not have to be a child, but from personal experience and losing several babies, sometimes, like, not having that tangible body, it, like, really hurts your brain. Mm-hmm. It's like you can't, it's almost like you're mourning something and it means so much to you, but to other people, it literally never existed.
Mm-hmm.
So having a physical monument or a physical location or a tombstone or XYZ, it is a physical manifestation and the only thing you have left of this thing that is so real to you and the only proof that you have that it's real. And when you're doing that and you're saying no, you're depriving these people of a connection to a person they don't have.
Mm-hmm.
They just wanted... They know that that is the last place this person they loved was seen alive. That's all they have. And you mean to tell me, with what I pay in taxes and what I know people in Vermont are paying in taxes, you mean to tell me that girl can't have a memorial for her family to have somewhere? Fucking sick, America. Sick.
Sick.
This is sick. Okay, I am off the box. Thank you. Thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
Sick. On September 14th, 2021, the police announced that bone fragments had been found on Loon Mountain in Lincoln, New Hampshire, 25 miles east of the crash site. She had been to the mountain before and had knowledge of the area, according to her sister, and the fragments were described as pretty small. It was not expected, and it was expected to take at least 2 months to determine if they were her remains or not. And so the reported later in November that it was not her remains. In January of 2022, the FBI issued a national alert on her case and created a violent criminal apprehension profile, allowing multiple law enforcement agencies to share any information they might have relating to the case. And, yeah, they're still, as of July 2022, doing searches.
Okay. Do you have any theories? Because I have two.
Okay, tell me.
The first one is the more obvious and standard, trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
You see a vulnerable person on the side of the road. It sounded to me like she was going for a nice weekend away, planning to study, planning to mm-hmm. have a good time, whether it be with a guy, a girl, whatever, friends. She had plans. She ran over on the side of the road. They see her. She doesn't want somebody to call the police because she's drinking and driving and having a good old time. But she's with somebody. So, like, that's the weird thing to me. So that's why I have a very specific theory that I have nothing to support whatsoever. Mm-hmm. This is just, like, a fan theory, if you will.
Yes.
I feel like the reason she was so distraught when her sister got out is because she was fucking the sister's fiancé or they were hooking up in some way. And I think that they planned to run away together because the sister was released. And she was having, like, an issue with the sister because she had this relationship with him, and that would make sense why the fiance would be so douchey as to go and, like, fucking take her to the liquor store, as well as why the boyfriend would be so close-lipped about things.
Hmm.
And either they successfully ran off together, or, like, the sister and the boyfriend found out and took him out. Those are my theories, like, my legit theories. I feel like I just feel in my heart that's what it has to do with.
That's crazy. That's wild.
Because it does line up. Like, mm-hmm. your sister's out, and you're like, oh shit, oh no, like, I don't know if this is gonna happen, and like, and I'm not trying to speak ill of the missing, by the way, it's just, this is just like, my, that's what we're all here for, mm-hmm. theories, discussions, whatever. I'm not saying she's like, this is clearly not fact-based, she's right. probably not doing any of this, but that makes sense in my mind.
Yeah.
Like, I could see some shit like that. Like, she packed, like, she was going on a romantic weekend,
mm-hmm.
but she's not going with her boyfriend.
Weird.
But who else would she be going with?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I do.
That's where I'm at. You don't have any theories?
No.
Okay.
I like your theories, though.
Okay, thank you. Okay, bye.
Bye.